Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Kavanaugh confirmation hearing started today. Hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh started today in the U.S. Senate. The hearings should take up most of the week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell hopes to get Kavanaugh confirmed well before November's midterm elections. Here's why. Should the Democrats win back the House and possibly the Senate, McConnell wants to be sure that he has the votes on the Supreme Court to withstand the challenge should Congress bring charges against the president for obstruction or any other high crime or misdemeanor resulting from the Mueller report. But why even put on this show? Trump told us he would nominate potential justices who would overturn Roe, and that's what he's doing. Look, it's not about is he a good guy, great youth basketball coach, wonderful husband, father, professor, who knows the law. It should be about will he be a fair and unbiased arbiter of the law and apply the Constitution to the facts that come before him. But Trump went to the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, got their list of conservative justices to meet the overturn Roe and affirmative action requirement because that's what his so-called evangelical base and ultra-right supporters want. That's how Kavanaugh's name got to Trump. Finally, if this were not a show hearing, why did Schumer reach an agreement last Tuesday with Senate Majority Leader McConnell to fast-track the confirmation of 15 of Trump's nominated judicial picks? 7 federal judges were confirmed that very day. McConnell never allowed Obama's pick, Merrick Garland, to even have a hearing, and Schumer goes along to get along. 2 wings on the same bird. Trump warns Syria, Russia, and Iran against reckless attack on Idlib. Donald Trump has warned Bashar al-Assad and his allies, Iran and Russia, quote, the Russians and Iranians would be making a grave humanitarian mistake to take part in this potential human tragedy. Hundreds of thousands of people could be killed. Don't let it happen, end quote. Trump tweeted that earlier today. So it's a human tragedy for Assad to move on Idlib, but it's not a human tragedy for the U.S. to support the Saudis in Yemen and the U.S. to support the Zionists as they try to exterminate the Palestinians. Help me with this logic. Here's the point. Idlib is the last rebel stronghold. If it falls, Assad wins the war. Many believe Assad has already won. Americans need to be asking themselves, who is the enemy and who is America supporting? The rebels holding Idlib are ISIS fighters. I thought ISIS was the enemy. Why would the U.S. consider the elimination of ISIS fighters from Idlib and the resulting civilian casualties a catastrophe? They never thought of the war in this region. They never thought of any other war in this region in that context before. Trump is preparing Americans for a serious escalation of the war. Don't be fooled. The only way the rebels can get the U.S. and other forces to engage is another false flag chemical attack. Amazon becomes second trillion-dollar company in the U.S. Amazon has become the second U.S. public company to cross the $1 trillion valuation threshold this year, 1 month after Apple did so. The company's blowout success has made its founder and CEO Jeff Bezos number one on Forbes' billionaires list this year. But here's the thing. This is great success, but upon whose backs and at what cost? Amazon warehouse workers are forced to pee in bottles or forego their bathroom breaks entirely because fulfillment demands are too high, according to journalist James Bloodworth, who went undercover as an Amazon worker in the UK. Workers who pick up products for delivery at a warehouse in Staffordshire, UK, use bottles instead of the actual toilet, which is located too far away, Bloodworth reported. They are afraid of being disciplined for idling and losing their jobs as a result, he added. Bloodworth told The Sun in an interview that the warehouse resembled a prison or an airport with high security scanners that check workers for banned items like hoodies, sunglasses, and phones, and other employees who pat down workers to check for stolen goods. According to the survey by worker rights platform Organize, which reported that 74% of workers avoid using the toilet for fear of being warned that they had missed their target numbers, Rising goals have also taken a toll on employees' mental health, as 55% of them report having suffered depression since working at Amazon. Over 80% of workers said they would not apply for a job at Amazon again. Colin Kaepernick chosen as face of Nike campaign. Nike is going with former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick as the new face of its Just Do It campaign. Kaepernick tweeted a photo of himself with the slogan, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." Nike is celebrating the 30th anniversary of its Just Do It slogan. Russell Okung, an offensive tackler for the LA Chargers, wrote on Twitter, "Be like Nike, don't be like Papa John's." The Daily Stormer, a white supremacist website, published an article asking whether Papa John's was the official pizza of the alt-right. Here's the interesting thing. Former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who's been tweeting with greater frequency as of late, called Kaepernick one of the greatest quarterbacks in the league. I didn't know he followed football. You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh started today in the U.S. Senate, and the hearings should take up most of the week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell hopes to get Kavanaugh through well before November's midterm elections. For greater insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's the director of the Washington, D.C. office for the Legal Defense Fund, overseeing the LDF's policy and legislative work and coordinating and implementing strategy on federal civil rights legislation. She is Ms. Leslie Prohl. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Hi, thank you so much. I just wanted to correct the record there. That's my previous job. I'm now advising the NAACP on judicial nominations.
Oh, thank you very much for the correction.
Sure.
I won't make that mistake again. So, where are we, in your opinion, with the Kavanaugh hearing based upon what we saw today?
Well, let me just first say, you know, this is the battle of a generation. This is to fill Justice Anthony Kennedy's seat, who was a reliable conservative, but whose vote was always in play. He voted to uphold affirmative action. In one instance, he certainly supported marriage equality. And we were able to obtain his vote in other cases. Brett Kavanaugh is not somebody who we think that that's possible. We've known him for 12 years on the bench. The NAACP actually opposed his nomination to the D.C. District Court. D.C. Court of Appeals, where he sat for 12 years. So this is something that is very, very important for everybody to know about. The stakes could not be higher. So today was the first day of the nomination hearing. So this is now my ninth Supreme Court nomination I've worked on, and I've never seen a more interesting first day. Usually, the hearing just opens, and there are statements from each senator, and it gets fairly tedious fairly quickly, and then the nominee gives an opening statement, and everybody goes home, and the questions start the next day. That did not happen today. That is because there is an unprecedented withholding of documents, first of all, the records of this nominee from the Bush administration for three whole years. They have refused to give records about any of that time. With respect to other parts of his background, they have been releasing records but not making them available to the public. They've been available only to the committee, and with other records, they're just saying they're invoking the executive privilege, which means that we're never going to be able to get to see them. So that we expected lots of fireworks today, and we got them. Beginning of the hearing, from the very beginning of the hearing, when Senator Grassley, who chairs the committee, He put down the gavel. Senator Kamala Harris immediately objected and said, I want to move to adjourn the hearing. We can't go forward. These documents, these records, this is this nominee's background. He's been nominated to a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land. And then after that, every other Democratic senator objected. So for the first hour and a half, there were a lot of sparks flying, and I have never seen anything like that before. It finally settled down, but not much. And the rest of the day, the senators were giving their statements. And then at the very end, he was introduced by three persons, and then he gave a statement, and then they adjourned until tomorrow morning when the senators are going to start questioning him, which is where the real sparks fly.
So I need you to really educate me here on this, because your insight and experience here is vastly greater than mine. With everything that you've just laid out, with all of the things that the Republicans failed to turn over to the Democrats in terms of background information on Merrick Garland, and they keep talking about the billions of pages they've already turned over, but understanding that McConnell never allowed Merrick Garland to have a hearing, and understanding that there was all of the information that they wanted that they never got, Chuck Schumer allows 15 of Trump's picks to go through uncontested. They got seven people through. They got seven people confirmed in one day last week. With all the sparks flying, help me understand, where does that get us? Because seems to me like Chuck Schumer's just going along to get along, and he's going to be confirmed, and we're stuck.
Well, that's exactly right. Think about it. We're going into a week of Supreme Court nomination hearings, okay? I've described how the stakes could not be higher, but we know Justice Kavanaugh would be horrible on civil rights. The week before the hearing, the minority leader, Schumer, decides to allow all these district court judges to go through without making the GOP jump through any of the hoops that are available under the Senate rules. And what it means is those judges are now judges. They could now sit on the bench. And we're saying to them, you need to use each and every tool. If you can't stop them, you need to delay them. Because one day, one week of not having a judge on the bench is better than having them. And so we have asked them to do that. We were very surprised and frankly very disappointed when he signaled right before this incredibly important week that they were caving on another procedural tool that they had still in their shed. And so you're absolutely right. It's something that a lot of civil rights groups were very upset about, because, you know, the Republicans have always gotten the courts. And we need to get the courts, and we need to fight for the courts, because that's where our rights get decided. And that's why we're trying at the NAACP to get everybody activated about this. It's not only you call your senator, just like voting, you get your family members, your colleagues, your friends to call their senators at the same time and stop this nomination.
You know, to your point about we need to have the courts, and again, if I'm wrong here, please correct me. The last time we had the court was the Warren Court. And folks need to take a minute and look at all of the incredibly positive civil rights and civil liberties law that came out of the Warren Court. We got the Brown decision. We got the Miranda decision. We got a ton of that the beginning of Roe v. Wade in terms of right to privacy came out of the Warren Court. There were so many things that came out. If folks had any insight into this in terms of what came out of the Warren Court for the average citizen, the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, not being able to use evidence that was obtained illegally based upon a bad warrant, so many things. And to your point, we need to get court back. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. And in fact, it was the Warren Court that got the other side agitating about the court. It was Brown. It was the desegregation ruling, and then it was everything else that you mentioned. And so they've been gunning for this forever, and they have been activated. Their base is activated. They know how to weigh in, and we need to get just as strategic, just as active, and just as loud, frankly. And one of the things that you should know about this particular nominee and the Warren Court is he has really criticized the Warren Court, and he's done it through his praise of former Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who he views was somebody who turned back the progress of the Warren Court, particularly in the area of criminal justice.
There you go. In fact, really, really quick, what a lot of people need to understand is they didn't attack the Warren Court immediately. Berger came in, he chipped away at it. Rehnquist came in, he chipped away at it. Now, what's his name, the current guy?
Kavanaugh.
No, the current Chief Justice.
Roberts.
Roberts came in. He's chipped away at it. And now they're really going to not chip away at it. They're going to just tear the whole thing down.
Upend it. Absolutely right. Those are the stakes. And so I hope everybody who's listening takes an interest and call your senator. Blue state, red state, it doesn't matter. They need to know that you're concerned and that you're opposed.
Leslie Prohl, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your work, and look forward to having you back, because this isn't going to end well, and it's not going to end soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. You know, there's been an awful lot of unproven allegations being bantered about regarding Russian hacking in our election. And I've been saying for a very long time, it's not about the Kremlin, it's about Kobach. It's not about Russians, it's about Republicans. Now, Greg Palast and Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. are challenging Kobach and his interstate cross-check program in court. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's been called the most important investigative reporter of our time, up there with Woodward and Bernstein from The Guardian. He has broken front-page stories for BBC Television Newsnight, The Guardian, Nation Magazine, and now Rolling Stone. He's Greg Palast, and I always am happy to say, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Glad to be with you, Doctor.
Thanks, Greg. So you and Reverend Jackson are on a mission to fight back against the elections that are, as usual, according to your writing, victim to the contrivances of the far right branch of the GOP and in Congress, co-partisans that vote with them. Why are you suing Kobach, and what are you suing him for?
Well, we're going to sue Kobach and about 20 of his GOP voting officials who are using Jim Crow tactics to remove hundreds of thousands of voters in each of their states. And we're not talking a couple thousand. We're talking in Georgia, where Brian Kemp is Secretary of State. He's in charge of the voter rolls. He's in charge of the voting systems. And he is running for governor against Stacey Abrams, who would become, if elected, the first black female governor in the history of the United States. And so you have a situation. Talk about, if it happened in any other country, in Russia or anywhere else, where the guys running for office are in charge of counting the votes, determining who gets the vote, this is the problem we have. Chris Kobach's running for governor of Kansas. He's a Secretary of State, and he's running a massive Jim Crow purge vote operation. So we are suing. Who are we? So I am suing in 20 states as a journalist, and in several states we have co-plaintiffs. In Illinois, my co-plaintiff is the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Obviously, he's concerned nationwide, but as he's a voter in Illinois, in Chicago, he's our co-plaintiff there. where Illinois has joined a program, two programs. One is called CrossCheck, which is created by Chris Kobach of Kansas. He is, and I don't use the term lightly, he's a white supremacist. He works for a white supremacist organization called FAIR, and while he's Secretary of State, while he's running for governor. And he's come up with a system of removing voters by sending them a postcard. And you say, well, what's wrong with that? Here's the answer. He sends postcards mostly to voters of color that they have to return. He's in charge of the voter rolls, as are some of his Republican cronies. You don't return the postcard, you lose your vote. Purge by postcard. How do you get on his purge list? Well, his number one tactic is he created something, or he's in charge of something called Interstate Crosscheck. Now, he sold this thing called Interstate Crosscheck, saying he was on a hunt for people voting twice, and same person in two states. And I busted him on that in my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I literally confronted him with his lists. And for example, in the state of Georgia.
In fact, it's kind of funny to watch it because you went to a cookout.
An ice cream social.
An ice cream social. That's right. People in Kansas don't have cookouts. They have ice cream social. You went to an ice cream social with your laptop in your hand, and you busted him flat out. Go ahead.
Right, exactly. So I had to be in a place where, one, I wouldn't get shot. by the way, he keeps a toy 50 caliber machine gun glued to his car. I mean, this guy's a piece of work. I kid you not. And and he does have an automatic weapons company that he owns. So I have to be a little careful. And so I've confronted him. What he did was he came up with a list of people who he said were voting twice. People like James, people with the name James Brown, for example. In Georgia, there were over 500 gentlemen named James Brown. And believe it or not, they found not only James Brown voting in Georgia, but they found a James Brown voting in Detroit and a James Brown voting in Maryland and a James Brown, you know, voting in Missouri. So in St. Louis. So, and they say, oh, it's obviously got to be the same James Brown, even though they had different middle names. Very important to know that. Different middle names, someone with Junior, James Brown Jr. and James Brown Sr. matched. So it was a con that these were double voters, but they could still lose their vote.
And weren't they supposed to validate to prevent this double counting by, I hate to use the term, cross-checking or cross-referencing based upon Social Security number?
Right. They were supposed to use the last four socials, but they don't.
Right.
They collect them, which is a dangerous process. You don't want a lot of agencies passing around Social Security numbers. It's only the last four numbers, but still. But they don't actually use them. I mean, obviously someone with mismatched middle name and junior and senior are not going to have even close to a match on Social Security. They're not even bothering matching the names, let alone birth dates and Social Security numbers. They are sending postcards out to all these people. And when I say all these people, we're talking 7 million people, overwhelmingly voters of color. And by the way, if you wonder why, how they do that, real simple. 85 of the 100 most common names in America, according to the census, are minority names. That means Garcia, Rodriguez, Jackson, Brown, Kim.
Washington.
Lee, Washington. And those are minority names. And so it's easy to find a Harold Washington in many states voting, a James Brown voting, a David Lee voting, a Jose Rodriguez voting. So in supposedly more than one state. It's obviously a common name, but, you know, Jose Rodriguez is not a common name for a Republican, so they're not worried about that voter getting shoved off the list. And what they do is they say, Kobach and the people who are suing, the other, Jack Kemp of Georgia, as I mentioned, John Houston of Ohio, these guys send you a postcard. And if you don't return the postcard, and it looks like junk mail, and most people don't. In Ohio, where they actually measured it, 80% of the people who got these postcards didn't return them. Now here's why they remove you. Here's the new excuse. They're saying, well, we're removing these people not because they're double voters, because they removed. Are you ready for this? In Ohio alone, 500,000 people were removed. 500,000 people were removed from the voter rolls with this postcard trick. Overwhelmingly minority voters. Now they're not accusing them now anymore of being double voters. They're saying, oh, this is evidence these people have moved. Now, I have my movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and, you know, go to gregpalace.com, download it. It's free on Amazon Prime. But you'll meet a guy in Ohio who's on the list. His name is Donald Webster. You wouldn't be surprised to find out he's African-American, lives in Dayton. Donald Alexander Webster is his full name. They said he moved to Virginia. And he, when he moved, apparently he changed his middle name to Eugene. So there's a guy named Donald Eugene Webster Jr., by the way, Donald Eugene Webster Jr. in Alexandria, Virginia. And they're saying that's the same voter as Donald Alexander Webster in Dayton, which means obviously Donald Alexander Webster has moved. And so he's subject to losing his vote. He doesn't get the postcard, or if he doesn't get it, because a lot of these things go astray, or he gets it and doesn't return it, he loses his right to vote in Ohio. And that's what they half a million people who didn't return their postcards. Now, here's something interesting to think about, Wilmer. Some people listening are thinking, wait a minute. If the card comes back as undeliverable, like addressee moved, that is evidence, by the way, someone's moved. We have no problem with taking someone off the voter rolls if there's a card that says they don't live here anymore. Okay? I mean, that may mean that they moved down the street, but still, that's at least legitimate. But if a postcard doesn't get returned, addressee unknown or undeliverable, that's evidence the person did not move. That's evidence that the person is there. In other words, if they have not moved, they will get the postcard. And in fact, under the new, under the Patriot Act, this post office is supposed to carefully track moves and make sure that they don't send mail to people who aren't at an address.
Let me give three states, and this is based on your research. And people need to understand that numbers are something you do well because you are a University of Chicago trained economist. Trump victory margin in Michigan, 13,107 votes. Michigan cross-check purge list. How many people were removed from the voter rolls in Michigan? Against a 13,107 victory, 449,922 people. In Arizona, 85,257 is the margin of victory for Trump in Arizona. 270,824 people, legally registered voters, were removed from the list. Finally, North Carolina, 177,008 was the margin of victory for Trump in North Carolina. 589,393 people were removed from the voter rolls. If cross-check isn't in play, and Greg, if I'm wrong here, correct me, Donald Trump is not your president.
That is correct. And yesterday I actually filmed a discussion of the mathematics. And obviously, there's more than just cross-check, this one, and postcard at play. There are many things at play. But the truth is that, well, to put it bluntly, as one of my fellow statisticians, I used to teach statistics, and my fellow statisticians at the University of Minnesota said, there's just not enough white guys to elect Donald Trump. Eliminate.
There we go. And so now, you are regular with me. We talk about this a lot. Folks, one of the reasons, above and beyond the fact that Greg is now taking this to court and is suing Kris Kobach, Greg, explain how, in spite of these machinations, people can still prevail.
Two things. Number one, overwhelm the steal. In other words, from my calculations, I did some work with Bobby Kennedy for Rolling Stone, and we pretty carefully calculated the various methods of suppressing, that is, stealing the vote. And it's about 5%. About 6 million in 120 million votes for president, for example. So you can't win with 51% anymore in our democracy. If you are a progressive candidate, you're going to need 56%. That's what Obama did. He just crushed them. And I can tell you right now that in 2008, for example, 5.9 million voters of color lost their votes, had their votes blocked, their votes not counted, all kinds of stuff. They got provisional ballots, which were thrown in the garbage. But Obama won handsomely in 8. because he simply crushed the opposition. So that's number one. It should get you mad enough to vote so that you, so that if there's a, basically it comes down to a 1 in 20 chance your vote's never going to get counted if you are African-American. Well, a 1 in 20 in America. If you're African-American, it's about 1 in 7 chance that your vote will never get counted. So the answer is you better make up for it by having your cousin vote as well, making sure he doesn't miss. The other is this. One way to defeat the purge by postcard and similar purging systems where they remove you from the voter rolls is check your registration, and if you have to, re-register online. Don't tell me you've been voting at the same station for 20 years. I don't care. Especially if you've got a common name, go to your Secretary of State's website. See if your name is there. And if your name is suddenly missing, re-register online on the spot. And I would do that today because in many states we are hitting the voter registration deadline for this November as we speak. And I got to tell you, there's one guy, I was very shocked to find out someone was missing from the voter rolls. Me. I'm in California. I went on the website to I was on the air like I am with you, and I said, I'm going to show you how to do it, like a little TV show. I said, so watch here. So I see you can, it's very easy, type in your name. I typed in my name, California, no such voter. And I re-registered right on the spot. So please, you can save your own vote and then make sure you vote, because the last thing you want to do is steal your own vote. You know, that we have such a drop-off in voting in these midterm elections when there's no president on the ballot. Please vote. Vote early if you're in a state with early voting. Show up, vote early at your convenience.
Two questions. Hopefully I can get them both in quickly. One, and you mentioned this early in the conversation, but I'd like for you to get into it a little bit deeper. You wrote, let's not celebrate Georgia victory too quick, wherein you state Brian Kemp, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, is removing voters from the rolls as he's running for governor against Democrat nominee Stacey Abrams, who would be the first black woman elected if it's not stolen from her. Give a little more detail about what's going on in Georgia and why.
All right. So in Georgia, this purge by postcard system is in full swing, and that's run by Jack Kemp, who's running for governor. So guys, purging the voter rolls, on which he's bleaching the voter rolls white while he's running. But the other thing is that he's doing other tricks. He's sending consultants around the state telling counties to close voter stations. In other words, reduce the number of polls, reduce the number of polls. That we know that if you reduce the number of polls, you make it harder for people without cars, you make it harder for voters of color to vote. And I can tell you, I can give you an example. In Georgia's 6th congressional district, I looked at the map. The southern part of the district is in the suburban or the edge of Atlanta. That's your Democratic area, that's your African-American area. They closed a whole bunch of polls in that area alone, not in the white areas in the north part of the district, but only in the African-American neighborhoods. That's where they closed down polls. So that's one of the ugly tricks that they're playing, is closing polls. The other trick that they're doing is ID laws. Make sure that you have the proper ID, that you have your driver's license or a passport, and make sure, and here's the other thing, people show up with the right ID and find out that the state had made a mistake and put in the wrong middle initial for you. You know, someone coded your little form you filled out. Make sure it's correct. So Georgia is one of those states, and South Carolina, for example, is using also exact signature match. Your signature has to look exactly like it did when you registered. Take a look at that signature. Make sure that that is your correct signature. And whatever you do, you know, don't add an initial. Don't change it. It's got to be just as you registered. I mean, these are crazy tricks. And you'll love this one. Most people, you know, like in the Asian American community, some people's signature is actually in Chinese or Korean characters.
Hmm.
They registered to vote, and most of them use their English script signature. But then on an absentee ballot, they're asked to sign it and it says, add your signature, and some will add their Chinese character, Korean character signatures. Most Asian Americans vote Democratic, about 75%. Their votes are being disqualified in several states because, you know, again, they're playing games with the signature. You know, the whole point of matching signatures is to make sure you don't have a fraudulent voter, not to remove Asian Americans, not to remove black voters, not to remove, you know, the purpose of this stuff is to stop voter fraud. And there's no fraudulent voters because Wilmer, who is going to go to jail for 5 years to cast one lousy vote?
Nobody I know.
It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. But they accuse, especially black voters, Hispanic voters, Asian American voters, of doing just that, of committing voter fraud en masse, of illegal aliens crossing the border. And this is just the type of nonsense stuff. In Alabama, you'll see in the one in the longer version of my film is the day after the Supreme Court said you could use these you could require a photo ID, picture ID, state ID to vote. They closed every single DMV, every single motor driver's license office in the 10 black belt counties of Alabama.
You know, the other thing that just amazes me, again, all this rhetoric, all of this dialogue and diatribe about foreign entities invading our system, and nobody's talking about, even if the stories of Russian hacking were true, even if that's true, the bigger problem is still the domestic threat, not the foreign threat. And you can listen to CNN, you can listen to MSNBC, you can listen to all these Democrats on these networks and all this discussion about voting, and they're not talking about the most fundamental element of this that there is.
500,000 voters were removed in Ohio, and it wasn't by the Russians. It was by a Republican functionary named John Husted, using this stuff of sending out postcards to black folk, and they, like most people, I think it's junk mail, throw it away, and they lose their vote. That wasn't Russians telling them to send the postcards. It was the GOP. And I was asked on MSNBC, am I afraid of the Russians stealing Ohio? And my answer, they did not like. I said, there's no Republican in Ohio that needs lessons from some kid in Moscow on how you steal the votes of voters of color. They're very, very good at it. They've been doing this Jim Crow operation a very long time, and they're getting much better at it. And they don't need any Russian help. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And you know, it's in Illinois, yes, there was an attempt to get what I found very funny, by the way, in Illinois, if you could call it funny, given the fight I'm going through with Reverend Jackson to stop the Jim Crow operations, there's no question that there was an attempt by the Russians to download the voter files of Illinois. But I have to tell you, you know what? How you download the voter files of Illinois? You go to the Secretary of State's website, and you hit a button that says download. That's their hack, is that they simply went to the website where if you want the voter rolls, because the voter rolls, the basic voter rolls, are public. They're everyone's voter rolls. We're a democracy. Your vote is secret, but whether you vote and if you vote is not a secret. That's how you keep a democracy a democracy. So all you have to do is go to the site and hit download. So the big hack, as far as I could tell, was they went to the website. Someone in Russia hit download. But no one's saying that the voter rolls are messed with, except by the Republicans. And this is the game that I cannot get the attention of most of the mainstream press. I mean, I get some, you know, but mostly it's, like I say, my work. If you know Greg Palast, I'm in Rolling Stone, and you can obviously get my film or read my books. But it's not easy to get away from this narrative that it's outsiders, because we don't want to admit that we still have Jim Crow voting in the United States and that we still have an apartheid electoral system. And we will never correct the problem till we admit it. It's like an alcoholic. You gotta say, I'm an alcoholic. We have to say, we have apartheid voting in America, and it's got to come to an end.
You said just now that you were on, I think you said MSNBC, and you gave them this answer, and they did not like your answer. Explain to me, because that to me is a very, very, very important point. You would think that a program, I don't know if it was Rachel's show or if it was Joanne, or it was probably Joanne because I've seen you on there a number of times. You would think that they would go, what? Oh my goodness! Please, Greg, explain to us why! So you would think that would be the response. So explain to me how you realized they didn't like your answer, and what did that mean?
What it means is that I used to be a regular on MSNBC with all the hosts. And as soon as I gave the wrong answer, because their whole, they've gone completely berserk with the Russians. And, I'm not saying I'm even an expert at, I'm not talking about whether Trump had meetings or any of that stuff. I'm not an expert in that. But I am an expert in the voting systems. And the voting systems, the problem with the voting systems is not someone hacking in, not anyone hacking the actual computers. The problem is the official apartheid actions, the racist actions of voting officials in places like Ohio, John Husted. I'm not saying he's a racist. I don't know him personally, and I don't really care. The fact is that he has been very good at removing voters of color from the voter rolls. Ohio should not be a purple state. They call it a swing state. It's only swinging because they removed 500,000 voters who should not have been removed. And it's not a swing state. Georgia should not be a Republican state. And it's not that I'm in love with the Democratic Party. I'm not. I'm talking about voters' choices. If you look at the demographics of Georgia, it should be a solid blue state. But massive, massive attack on the right to vote, whether it's closing polling stations or removing people from the voter rolls, or, by the way, simply not counting their ballots, which is another problem we have. We call it spoilage. Votes simply don't get read by the machines. And that happens, according to the U.S. government, you're 900% more likely to have your vote not counted for a technical reason than if you're white. 900% more likely your vote simply won't be counted. Like the machine couldn't read it, it got folded, it got damaged, it got dirty, so the optical reader couldn't read and they throw it away. 900% higher if you're black than if you're white.
Let me stop you there. We will bring you back. Greg Palast, as always. Go to Greg Palast, PALAST.com, GregPalast.com. Thanks, Greg.
You're welcome.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is still more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. According to my next guest, the Women's March on the Pentagon, which is scheduled for October 20 and 21, is an important part of anti-war autumn activities. We've got to put the so-called New Wave Democrats on notice that we're not going to allow them to get elected without clearly stating where they stand on U.S. militarism. Let's get insight into this from my guest, Dr. Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the Black Alliance for Peace. Dr. Baraka, as always, man, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leon. It's a pleasure to be back.
So as we look at this so-called progressive Democrat blue wave that is supposed to be looming on the horizon, the discussion and direct action of war and peace and the military-industrial complex is not in the forefront. What's going on?
Well, because there is a collusion between both wings of the ruling class, represented by the Democrat Party and Republicans, to support the permanent war agenda of that class. So there's no opposition to the military moves being made by the U.S. state. In any of the places where we find U.S. forces. And that's a very dangerous situation because we are heading toward the midterms. But the issue of war and militarism is now part of the discourse. And it's dangerous because we know that the Trump administration is desperate for a political win. And many of us believe that there will be an October surprise, if you will. And that October surprise will most likely be some kind of military action in Syria. with the full support from the Democrats, reluctantly, because they know that if there is a military assault, there's going to be a wave of U.S. nationalism, and it's going to strengthen the GOP prospects for the midterms.
We know that history tells us that the country does not want to change leaders or leadership in the midst of conflict. And history is replete with that. This may be a silly question, but please explain the difference between war and militarism.
Well, you know, militarism could take different forms. It could be indirect military systems, military to military training, militarizing a society that is putting them on a war footing. War, of course, is more brutal, more direct. Straight up intervention, death and destruction. So the U.S. is responsible for both militarization and war. Militarization also takes the form of these obscene levels of military arms being sold around the world. So both the issue of the arms trade, state violence, and direct war should be issues debated as part of the midterms. But again, because we have both parties committed to the national security strategy of complete and total global domination, they're not talking about the role that the military plays to ensure U.S. Hegemony.
I talked about this last week, and I'd like for you to elaborate on this October surprise. Because folks might just think that because you're the executive director of the Black Alliance for Peace, that under every rock you find a war. But if you listen, if people pay attention to the news and to the rhetoric, last week Trump was tweeting and others were discussing about another gas attack. Assad was warned about a gas attack against the rebels in Idlib, which is the last real rebel stronghold in Syria. What didn't get reported was that the UN was getting reports that the gas attack was going to be a false flag operation. And honestly, it didn't make any sense. If you think about it from the Assad perspective, he's winning the war. Why would he do something that he knows would bring international condemnation and bring the United States in to support his opposition? That just makes absolutely no sense. But would you please explain a little bit about Idlib, about Trump warning Syria, Russia, and Iran against a reckless attack when it doesn't really seem to be that was on their minds?
It's a very interesting situation in Syria because we have the U.S. making these warnings. And the first question that one has to raise is, what should the U.S. have to do with Syria? And why is the U.S. in fact in Syria when it has not been invited by the Syrian government? There's no mandate given to the U.S. to be inside Syria. And if there is a move on the part of these various forces to attempt to resolve that situation in Syria, all the U.S. should be able to do is to request a seat at the table, not demand that the Syrian government not attempt to take back territory being militarily held by rebel forces, many of which are foreign forces. It makes no sense. And as you said in your comment or question, we fully expect that there could be a false flag operation. It makes no sense for the Assad government to, in fact, engage in a chemical attack. But even though it doesn't make any sense, we have seen in the past that that propaganda move on the part of the U.S. and its Western allies has been quite effective. People are not thinking. All they know is that there's been an attack in some kind of way. The U.S. has some kind of moral responsibility to respond. So as we look at the last phase of this war, we're very concerned about not only the U.S. getting involved in directly, but we're concerned about the the pressure that the Trump administration has on itself politically to get more directly involved militarily. That's where the real danger is. And that's why we have to have clear voices in opposition. We have to demand that these politicians running for office should be required to make a definitive comment on where they stand on U.S. militarism and war in Syria and in other parts of the globe.
In fact, I wanted just to quickly get to the point when you say other parts of the globe, Trump's tweet saying that if Syria and Russia and Iran go into Idlib to remove the rebels, this will be an incredible humanitarian crisis. But it's odd that there's no humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And the United States is backing the Saudi play to eliminate, ethnically cleanse Yemenis from Yemen. But for some reason, there's no humanitarian crisis there.
Nor is there a humanitarian crisis when the Israeli forces shoot down dozens of Palestinians on the border in Gaza. So, look, everybody understands the game. This is propaganda. What we have to do is try to raise people's awareness, their consciousness of how these powerful entities, these powerful states, attempt to manipulate us into supporting their agenda. We say that we want to support and be on the side of human life. That means being opposed to any of these efforts to escalate these situations militarily, to give our support to any kind of justification for direct military conflict when there's a possibility that that conflict can be avoided. If the so-called rebels in Syria, if they decided to put down their arms and for those foreign fighters to, in fact, leave that territory, then there's a strong possibility that a military assault can be avoided. But they're giving false hope from statements from the Trump administration and others, giving the impression that there may be some kind of last-minute direct military intervention on the part of the U.S., and that's dangerous.
And we can take it out of Yemen, and we can take it out of Syria. Someone who's listening, we have just about a minute left, can ask themselves, why should we spend $619 billion on the military when the school system in Detroit has to shut off its water fountains because you can't give school children clean drinking water in the city of Detroit?
Because we have allowed ourselves to be manipulated by the 1% into transferring our resources directly from our pockets to theirs. So we've got to wake ourselves up. We've got to oppose their agenda, because their agenda of war and destruction is not our agenda. We're the ones that die, and the poor people and working class people around the world are the ones that die also. That's why taking a resolute anti-war position and an anti-imperialist one also is a historic necessity for us at this critical moment.
Gil Scott-Heron said, ask them what they're fighting for, and they'll never tell you the economics of war.
Exactly.
There's big money in those bombs. That's why Trump could send 25 Tomahawk missiles into Syria and not hit a darn thing, and nobody complained.
We say close those military bases around the world, transfer that $150 billion back to the people so that we have heat in the schools of Baltimore and clean water. We say reduce the military budget by at least 50% in the beginning, and transfer that money to fixing up the infrastructure in the country, providing some summer jobs for young people. There's a lot we can do with that money.
Dr. Ajamu Baraka, thank you so much for your time this evening, and look forward to getting you back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, and thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.